Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
That's, yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, not say it to now.
I'm down Twanfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Well, that was a crushing bloody disappointment, wasn't it? Hello and welcome to today's Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hello there, Ken.
Hello, Kieran, how are you?
Why that was such an absolute dog of a game yesterday is the key question we shall be grappling with on this bank holiday Monday. Man City and Arsenal mustered 3 shots on target between them, one of just 3 games to see 3 or fewer in the Premier League this season, which also includes the reverse meeting between the two sides in October, which also had only 3 shots on target. So why are Pep and Arteta ruining English football, Ken? Is this a fair question to ask? I think so, even though I was actually in Crow Park yesterday, so I didn't actually have to sit through it all live. I didn't feel robbed of my Sunday in the same way that others might, or indeed you might have, Ken.
Oh yeah, well, I noticed there was a game involving Derry?
There was. Oh God, you're just, that news nose of yours is just on point today. And over the weekend,
there was something,
Ken. Yes, Dublin.
Derry, were Derry playing Dublin?
Dublin were playing Derry, yes, in the National League
and
Division
I believe
1 final.
I saw a few flickers of, this is why Gaelic football is the greatest game in the world.
The greatest game that was ever played by any man.
The greatest sport that was ever played by any man.
There was a bit of that going on now. It sounded pretty good.
There was.
And that was,
it was refreshingly free of the spectacle. I mean, I was doing it last year for a cricket match. Cork and Derry were playing in the Ireland quarterfinal. I ended up watching most of, you know, the third test, the last day of the third test of the Ashes series, because the Gaelic football was so crushingly boring while I was in Crow Park. Whereas yesterday, there wasn't a mobile phone inside, Ken.
Just people living in the moment.
Just people living in the moment. No one whispering silently that, oh my God, it's 3-2. And I was kind of, you know, I've often been, you know, sitting there thinking, oh, maybe I should be at home double screening this. There was none of that yesterday, Ken. I was left free and easy to enjoy all 70 minutes of ordinary time, all 20 minutes of extra time, and indeed the penalties. And no one was whispering in my ear about Man City Arsenal, other than for people to turn to me and say, this sounds like it was an absolutely terrible bloody game.
Sure, if you'd make a criticism of the game at all, it was there wasn't enough minutes in it.
That was the problem.
Dublin Derry, I mean.
That was the problem. 90 minutes of hot action.
Trying to be critical is going to be impossible.
And this was after also another incredible Dublin football occasion on
Friday night.
Hang on. Was it Friday night? Yeah.
Yeah. Bulls Rovers, Friday night.
Friday night, more than 10,000 people at Shamrock Rovers to see Shamrock Rovers defeat Bohemians by 3-1. Interesting last goal in the game. I mean, obviously the result was no longer in doubt, but I was struck by that late Bohemians goal. Remarkable. Declan McDade kind of scored, but it was more the Shamrock Rovers goalkeeper, Leon Poles, seemed to lose his bearings in a rather serious way and was kind of running away from the, well, where he kind of needed to be to stop the shot, which I was astonished by.
You were taken by.
Well, I was like, I can't remember seeing a goal quite like that before. It was notable, actually, when I was watching this game on TV, to see the images of the crowd celebrating, you know, after Rovers' third goal.
Yeah.
How young the crowd is compared to, you know, if you're used to watching Premier League games, you see plenty of old bangers at those. this was a young, vibrant, dynamic, the future. The future
stop
belongs
with the fucking genes, you know.
If the future doesn't belong to Derry football, it belongs to League of Ireland football. Then it was with a certain regret and sense of guilt that I plugged myself back into the Matrix to sit down and watch Manchester City against Arsenal. Mm. And, you know, for me, the job for Arsenal was clear. At the start of the play, they're leading in the table, City at home. Arsenal had one job. They knew the job. They came to do a job. They did the job on City. They got the clean sheet, got the point. Good job. Job's a good one.
Mm.
So for me, it seemed simple. We understood what happened. We understood the result. But for a lot of people, you know, a lot of people were saying maybe the viewers would need the patience of Job to sit through this. And not a lot of people have that. And it's caused a lot of debate, and it seems that there's more to it than Arsenal simply shutting up shop, going to Manchester, getting a point, which keeps them ahead of City. There's a lot more, and that's why we've recorded about 50 minutes of debate on this on this game, which is coming right up. And this is not April Fool's. This is real. This is reality. This is what's coming next.
And you will hear that conversation with Jonathan Wilson and John McKenzie in just a few minutes. There are 10 Premier League games on later this week. We'll be covering all of them on the World Service. There's also the not insignificant, but also not all that likely, matter of a new Ireland manager being unveiled at some stage this month. So why not have a think about signing up this month? It's a fiver a month, plus VAT, depending on where you are in the world. But for now, Ken, can you please report on some sport, please?
So there was some amazing football happening in the Premier Matrix League. We had Josh Cullen.
Just not in this title run-in game.
Well, you know, I mean, it wasn't the only title run-in game. So there's an unusual aspect about this Premier League season. The title run-in isn't just about two teams. And there was another pretty good game yesterday. But Saturday was just an unbelievable day. Like Josh Cullen and Dara O'Shea leading the charge for Craig Bellamy's Burnley at Chelsea. I mean, that was, you know, Burnley have a player sent off the first half, I think harshly. Big Vince Company thinks harshly. He gets sent off as well. Chelsea score the penalty that results from the sending off or the second yellow card sending off offence. Cole Palmer with a Panenka penalty. I mean, this really can't get too much worse for Burnley than it is at the moment. They end up drawing the game 2-2. I mean, 1-1, okay. Cullen scored a nice goal. I think his first Premier League goal.
It was indeed, yeah.
And then, you know, when Chelsea got the second goal, you think, okay, well, that's it. Like, with 10 men, you're not coming back twice. Dara O'Shea scores another goal. This one's a Cullen assist. And absolutely incredible. I mean, I don't know about the relegation situation. Maybe they're, you know, they need a few more points deductions to take out the teams around them. But that was an amazing, was an amazing day for them. The Newcastle West Ham match was incredible. You know, Calvin Phillips comes on and everything goes wrong for West Ham. Calvin Phillips then gives the finger to some West Ham fans. You know, who were sort of abusing him as he got on the bus after the game. Anthony Gordon. I mean, how good is Anthony Gordon, do you think?
Oh, this is a bit of a live debate in my brain, to be honest. He was very good on Saturday.
I think he's very good.
Yeah. I'm reluctantly coming around to that.
Yeah.
Because he's not the most likable footballer I've ever seen, I have to say. He's really, in fact, I would say he's an unlikable footballer. But yeah, he is pretty good.
Yeah.
He is pretty good. I mean, I, it did seem like an insane amount of money that Newcastle paid for him. But
yeah, I don't think it
turns
was.
Out he's pretty handy.
Yeah, I don't think it was a crazy amount of money. That might go down as one of Dan Ashworth's better deals from his time there. Better than Tonali, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, there's videos going around of Tonali deliberately getting himself booked. I mean, we see Tonali's been charged with betting offences relating to the time that he was as a Newcastle player, including after he'd already been banned. I mean, this is just absolutely incredible. So, I mean, there was a video which appeared to show him in the Villa, Newcastle's 5-1 win over Villa, getting himself booked by sort of just standing by the sideline when he's coming off the sub and waiting until he gets basically yellow carded before walking off the pitch, which you're just scratching your head looking at that and thinking...
I mean, there's a lot of really easy ways to get yourself booked.
Mm.
You know, like it's basically pull a player's jersey on a transition and you're guaranteed to get a yellow card.
Yeah.
That it just seems really
it's hard to know.
Be concerned about it. Yeah, you would be. Yeah,
we don't have the full facts. We don't know what happened there, but it did look really strange when you saw it. When you saw it back, certainly in the context of everything that's since emerged about Tonali, but I think that it definitely would have looked strange to anybody, any bookmaker who noticed that somebody somewhere in the world had bet on Sandro Tonali getting booked, and then this happened like 2 seconds before he left the field. But look, I guess he this did eventually come to the attention of the authorities. Anyway, it was a very good a good day for Newcastle. I mean, because at the point when West Ham were winning 3-1, you felt as though this could be it. This could be it for Eddie and Jace, but they pulled out of the fire. The you know what else was the Sheffield United had this incredible almost 4-1 up VAR goal disallowed and then 3-3. Rodrigo Muniz scoring. Rodrigo Muniz is a joke, by the way. This guy is ridiculously good.
Yeah, I mean, he played for a long time without playing half as well as this, but, I mean, he is now, I think it's 8 goals in 8 games, isn't it?
Yeah.
He does look really, and he was brilliant against Manchester United at Old Trafford, like 2 months ago. And I think that kind of since then, I've been keeping an eye on him, and every single week it appears he's scoring goals and scoring brilliant goals on Saturday. I mean, the it's not quite an overhead, is it? But it was an absolutely brilliant finish.
The good news for Arsenal is that they are not one of the title-chasing teams that actually have to play against Rodrigo Muniz with the other two do before the end of the season. So what was the other thing? Well, it was Liverpool against Brighton on Sunday. Again, this is a really good game. It was actually the same when Man City and Arsenal played the reverse fixture at the Emirates, which was also a terrible game. Liverpool and Brighton played the same day their reverse fixture, and it was again a brilliant game. Somehow, the combination of these two managers and teams produces interesting games.
Stars make fights, Ken.
Yeah. Well, it seems to work, and obviously this was sort of an audition. In a sense, for Roberto De Zerbi, who'd been saying things like, well, you know, of course I don't need to renew with Brighton. We have to talk to the club, see if they can match my ambition. I want to keep my ambition, of course.
Mm.
As there's rumours that he might be next for the Liverpool job, because the person who was obviously the perfect person for the Liverpool job and the ideal candidate for them to appoint, announced on Thursday... On Friday, actually, he did the press conference on Friday. The news sort of emerged on Thursday night that he was not going to be leaving Bayer Leverkusen. Xabi Alonso says he's going to stay at least one more season there. So Bayern,
this is a legit bombshell.
Well, yeah. You know, everyone kind of thought, well, look, I mean, Liverpool are chasing him, Bayern are chasing him. Real Madrid may not be actively chasing him right now, but, you know.
They're always in the market for a new manager. Yeah.
And he says no, he's going to stay. And this is surprising just because it's rare in football for people not to kind of, you know, automatically
jump
move
ship
up.
The second, yeah.
Yeah, but like, he's decided not to do that, which is something that didn't impress everybody, including the Sage of Doha, who was speaking about this to Andy Gray.
And he announced yesterday, Alonso, he's staying. Now, in my opinion, that is a huge mistake. At no other time in history will jobs at Liverpool,
yeah,
Munich,
yeah,
Manchester United.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Real Madrid.
Yeah. Maybe
those.
Two.
Maybe, but at no other point in history will these jobs all be available again. Right now, he can have his pick.
He can.
At no other point in his career going forward will he ever be in this luxurious position again. Ever. He might get Madrid at a different time. And now's a good time to get Real
Madrid,
by the way.
Now's a great time to get Madrid.
I would question the size of his cojones.
Would you really?
Leverkusen, because Bayer Leverkusen will never again have a season like this. Bayern Munich will make sure next year they have another decade of domination in German football.
Yeah.
Leverkusen might pick up the odd cup here and there. But so right now his stock is as high as it will ever be, and his opportunities are as broad and as great as they will ever be, and I think he has bottled it.
God, so that you think Leverkusen or Leicester, and he's bottled the job?
Absolutely.
Okay. Interesting.
Questioning the man's cojones, Ken.
Because he doesn't immediately jump at the first chance to get promoted up the ladder is a sign that he lacks
he's bottled
confidence.
It. Yeah.
He's bottled it because he's decided to stay at Bayer Leverkusen, even though what Richard Key says about, you know, Bayern will surely try and come back stronger and so on is undoubtedly true. Nevertheless, he is staying because he thinks that they can continue to do something great next season as well. And this shows somehow, you know, that he hasn't got the nerve. It's just amazing. I mean,
even from like just leaving aside Real and Liverpool for a moment, the idea that the brave option here is to go to the club that will probably sign Leverkusen's three best players in the summer and win the league by, you know, 20 points. Like, how do you think that's the brave option instead of the easiest possible option? In like, how do you make your life incredibly easy if you're Xabi Alonso? Take the Bayern Munich job. I mean, like, it's upside down world stuff, really, from the sage of Doha.
Well, it's utter nonsense, really, because you know, the idea that he suggests, you know, there will never be another moment in history when all of these jobs will be available. But it's a matter about all of the jobs being available at the same moment. I mean, that may be sort of true the stars have aligned in an unusual way, but not in a significant way. It doesn't matter whether they're all available at the same time or not. You can only take one of them at any one time. Will Xabi Alonso be in the frame for any of those jobs anytime that he wants? I mean, yeah. You know, I mean, Xabi Alonso has already done enough this season to guarantee that another big club will want to employ him. It doesn't even really matter what happens next season, although Alonso is clearly saying to himself, or clearly sending the message that he thinks they can continue. Like, Keyes called them Leverkusen, but Alonso clearly has a different assessment of it. He doesn't think this is like some, one in a billion run of like, oh my God, I can't believe we've done it again. I mean, they did it again over the weekend. They were losing in the 88th minute and ended up winning the game 2-1. I mean, this is just crazy. What's happening? Thomas Tuchel has conceded the title after Bayern lost 2-0 to Dortmund. He's already said congratulations to Leverkusen, it's over. So, you know, that's that trophy almost seems to be in the bag now, or at least it would require like the greatest collapse of all time at this point.
Literally no further points between now and the end of the season.
Yeah, but you know, I think he gets a lot of things right, but I don't think he got that one right. But in the meantime, Klopp still has a few more matches, and it must be sad for Liverpool to think that all this is coming to an end, because this game against Brighton was just absolutely incredible. I mean, this is just pure sort of drama. I mean, first of all, Danny Welbeck turns up. With the Welbeck's famous Zauberfuss, smashes Brighton into the lead in the second minute. Adingra absolutely running riot down the left side for Brighton, who had 70% of their attacks targeting Connor Bradley. And I was just thinking, imagine how relieved Trent Alexander-Arnold is watching this from the stands. You know,
that he's not playing.
What could be happening out there?
Yeah.
You know, and it does raise the question, actually, because Bradley, I think, played brilliantly, as he has so often, especially in the closing stages of the game, when it was about sort of staying composed and making the right decision, which he just kept doing. You know, having done his usual sort of attacking and winning the ball high up in the first half, that you are kind of thinking, where does Trent Alexander-Arnold fit into this team when he returns?
Midfield? You know,
maybe, but the midfield players all played really well. I mean, McAllister had an absolutely incredible performance for Liverpool. I mean, I think if Mo Salah had been shooting straight, he could have scored 4 or 5. I think Salah finished the game with 12 shots, which was two more than his previous record in the Premier League. And only scored once, had a few misses, and a couple were saved. Obviously, this is generally good. You know, if you're having... It's good to have 12 shots in the game. Ideally, you'd score more than one of those 12 shots. At the same time, if you score the winner, it ends up being enough. But just overall, you know, again, to be in, I think 23 times now they've been losing and come back to win. That sounds like it can't be true, yeah. But I've read it somewhere. So this is turning into...
It's an incredible roller coaster for like a fan base to be on. Mm. And, you know, it is... very rare for it to be happening like this with the knowledge that one of the, if not the key component of all of it, is not going to be in the job in 3 months' time.
Yeah, so enjoy it. Enjoy it while it lasts. Everybody, I think, was enjoying it yesterday. And then, of course, we had that, you know, then we had this other game. I mean, you can talk all about this Liverpool Brighton stuff, but is it serious? Is it really serious? You know, I'll tell you what was serious. I'll tell you what was deadly serious. Manchester City against Arsenal. And that's why we devoted the next 50 minutes to this program. That's why we've devoted 50 minutes to this program to talking about Manchester City against Arsenal and the philosophical implications of what we saw there.
Well, God, Jerry has controlled the ball basketball style.
Well, we are joined today by Jonathan Wilson. How are you doing, Jonathan?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Very well. And also by John McKenzie of TIFO Football at The Athletic. How are you doing, John?
Yeah, really great. It's great to be on this fine bank holiday Monday. I'm in a very empty office right now, but I'm always keen to talk about football.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was some football. I mean, there was a lot of great football over the weekend, but we're going to be mainly talking about the... a match between Manchester City and Arsenal, which I think is, you know, one of the more interesting nil-nils I've ever seen, because the question of how two such excellent teams can produce such an awful game is, I think, genuinely interesting. Have you got any theories about that, Jonathan?
I mean, was it? I don't know. I feel I was slightly spoiled because I was at Brentford on Saturday night. So the fact there was 3 shots on target in that entire game on Sunday, that was sort of like 90 seconds of Brentford on Saturday. So, yeah, I think it's one of those games that maybe is more interesting in the discussion and in the experiencing of it. I think football is becoming more defensive at the very elite level. So I know that the Premier League is averaging, is it 3.23 goals per
game? Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because this was you wrote a piece about how everybody, or how Arsenal and Man City more specifically, are using 4 centre backs, and you made this claim that's become more defensive. And I was thinking, is this not the highest goal scoring season since the 60s or whatever? What's he talking about?
Yeah, you can't legislate for, you know, Sheffield United and Burnley and Manchester United and Tottenham, the very elite level. So you look at the Champions League, since 2008, there's only been 4 seasons when goals per game in the knockout stage has fallen under 3. And 3 of them have been in the last 3 seasons, 3 of those 4. Equally, if you look at games between Arsenal, City and Liverpool this season, there's been 11 goals in 6 games, so under 2. So I think the very, very highest level, I think those coaches have seen this competitive advantage to be gained by remembering how to defend. Jurgen Klopp's actually been talking about that for 5 years. Yeah, he mentioned it after the 0-0 draw against Bayern at Anfield in 2019, that he thought football was going to go into a more defensive phase. I think those sort of 3-goal swings we became used to in the Champions League are not normal. I think they're probably not healthy. They're fun to watch, but they probably suggest
not
that
healthy.
The elite have forgotten how to defend. They've forgotten... Yeah, because I think what it shows is the massive imbalances that your PSGs, your Barcelonas... had forgotten how you hold on to a lead. They're not used to ever being under pressure. So you put them under pressure and they buckle because they don't know how to do it. Hmm. And I think Klopp quite rightly identified that this was an area where yeah, they've been in such a focus on being on the front foot, on being proactive, on trying to score goals that people had forgotten the other side of the game. And I think we have seen it's slightly complicated by the change in the away goals rule, which may or may not be significant in this. I suspect not as significant as some people are claiming. But I think we have seen football become more defensive at the very, very top level. And I think that's probably the way it was naturally going to go. And I think what we saw yesterday was an example of that. You know, Arsenal have conceded fewer goals than anybody else in the Premier League this season. Their XG against is much lower than anybody else in the Premier League this season. They are the best team in the Premier League. It's stopping the opposition from having chances. And that is why, you know, they got themselves in this position. The problem is it's not hugely exciting to watch. I mean, but it is a huge achievement when City had scored in 58 home goal games in a row to restrict them to one shot on target.
What about you, John? You've been listening patiently to this. Do you have any theories about why the game is so bad, or do you consider this to be a dishonest and leading question?
I think it's worth remembering that the comparative fixture last season was 1-4-1 by Manchester City, and I think that was probably a fairly important game in the origin story of Mikel Arteta, particularly in regards of what happened with the transfer window last summer and what we've seen from Arsenal this season. Clearly, he felt as though the issues that Arsenal had last season that meant that they ended up dropping out of the title race at the end were down to these defensive fragilities and frailties, and they've addressed that. And this season, it's allowed them to be a lot more, I think, consistent in the title race. I think the bigger picture aspect of this is, I think at the very elite level, we're talking. Pep and Arteta here. I think it's something that is very much unique to those two managers in terms of their sensibilities. Jonathan before mentioned, there are managers who have very different approaches to football. And Erik ten Hag and his Manchester United conceding 20 shots a game at the moment against, which is not what you expect elite teams to do. And Ange Postecoglou seemingly doesn't seem to believe in game state at all and is just going to attack regardless of what the scoreline is. So, but I think, in terms of the elite level football, high positional play that we're seeing from Pep Guardiola and Mikel Arteta, the emphasis very much is on tentativeness, cautiousness, making sure that you don't allow openings to be exploited. And the result is, I hate talking about chess in the context of football, but these games are very much chess matches in that one manager makes a move and it's played out for a few minutes, and then the other manager tries to counter that with another move, and then the original manager counters that move, and it goes on and on and on, and it's all about making sure that you're not allowing free men in between the lines and making sure that your structure is as tight as possible. And I can understand why, like, for the majority of fans, that is a bit of a boring snore fest, but I guess a lot of people don't like chess either, so I suppose that's sort of the way that I look at it. It's a horses for courses things. There's lots of different ways that you can play football, and different people will enjoy different forms of the game.
What about the fact that you've talked about the managers playing chess? Maybe the thing that a lot of people don't like is the idea that the players are pieces on the chessboard of these managers who loom over the whole thing. I mean, the thing that struck me from the game was, I mean, first of all, Trossard getting his very detailed instructions from Mikel Arteta before he came on, which seemed to go on for, I had no idea what, how much information or where, how he thought it was right to give Trossard talk to him for so long. And then obviously this moment with Grealish after the game from Guardiola, I thought a really resonant image, because you've got like the ultimate system manager here confronting the ultimate individual star player and just absolutely bollocking him in front of the world in a way that, I don't know, I think a lot of people looking at it thought, oh, Pep, why are you doing this? It wasn't just Richard Keys. I mean, the problem, John, I'm suggesting here is that the managers are all over this thing, and it's as though the players didn't have any kind of room to breathe.
Yeah, I think in a game like this, where Arsenal are clearly going to come and try and shut the opposition out, they're happy to take a draw. And I think the way that the game played out was very much in the first half, Manchester City caused lots of problems to Arsenal's press. So it meant that they felt very reticent trying to even press high up the field at all. This is part of the reason why they only put up whatever it was, 27% possession throughout the whole game. They pressed a little bit higher in the second half. So much of that kind of game where one team is sitting back and defending, I think, is about making sure that your structure is tight. And that means that you are going to give a lot of instructions to your players about who their marking responsibilities are, when they should be moving from different phases of the out of possession play. And in that respect, you know, I can understand why it would become a game where, for example, Leandro Trossard comes on. He's been given a huge amount of instructions about what he should or shouldn't do. I suppose the question for me is less so about do the managers have too much control here, and more, are these two managers just way too worried about taking risk-averse options? That's what it comes down to for me. Because regardless of what happens this season, it could be the case that the team that actually wins the league this season could be Liverpool, who very much don't take that kind of approach. They're not worried too much about making sure that they're not allowing any gaps to open whatsoever. They're happier for games to become a little bit more open and rely on the fact that they've got a talent advantage over most of the teams in the league, which allows them to win those games. And, you know, that's for me the way that this season has opened out. I think Liverpool have dropped a lot of points against teams at the very top of the league, but they've beaten everyone else fairly comfortably for the most part because they are willing to just be aggressive and attacking. And I think, yes, it's a high variance approach. You can definitely lose the league by playing in that way, but this season it's worked out for them. And I suppose at the end of the season, will Guardiola and Arteta be sat there thinking, well, we were ultra cautious, we made sure that we didn't allow any gaps to open up, and we still didn't win the league. What was the point of that at the end of the day? So yeah, I think this is what is happening right now in terms of the tactical theory. There's conversations about whether or not ultra cautiousness now works as an almost guaranteed way of winning the league in the Premier League, and yeah, I'd be interested to hear you guys' thoughts on whether or not, you know, not only from the point of view of the effectiveness of this approach, but in terms of the entertainment aspect, whether or not that's a pretty good thing for football, that we're maybe moving away into a bit more of an exciting era, perhaps.
Well, it maybe depends on who you're following on Twitter. You said earlier, Jonathan, that this game is maybe more interesting in the discussion than in the actual, you know, game itself. I wonder what you're getting at there. I mean, I was fascinated by a lot of what I saw. There's a very strong reaction to this game. You had like a one school of thought saying, oh, you know, any moment now some nerd is going to come along and tell us this is good, actually. Then you had some Arsenal fans who were saying stuff like, oh, you know, we're not here to entertain you. You know, we got a league to win. You know, if you want entertainment, go to the opera. So they sounded like that's basically the Giovanni Trapattoni line. So there was the Trapattoni school. But then there was this other more interesting school of, I would say, Arsenal-minded analysts who were saying things like, you know, you think Arsenal just went out there to defend? Well, I've got news for you. And then sort of laying out how actually this was kind of a brilliant attacking plan in disguise, which, you know, I don't know if David Raya taking 45 seconds over every goal kick was part of the strategy to win the game. I'm not sure. It seemed to me like a team that was going out there not to lose. But what did you make of it? What do you think Arsenal's game plan really was? And why did you find the discussion around it sort of so interesting?
I mean, I think you've outlined why the discussion was so interesting. There's so many strands to it. I sort of think on a psychological level, yesterday was interesting in that if you're Guardiola, you're going to that game without Edison, without Kyle Walker, without John Stones, you lose Nathan Ake midway through the first half, you're thinking, look, if we get out of this with a draw, it's fine. And City have the easiest run in. It's entirely plausible City win the next nine games. They've got to go to Tottenham, but that's the only sort of really tough-looking fixture they've got left. I'm pretty sure if they take 27 points in those nine games, they win the league. So from that point of view, I can see why Guardiola's mindset was don't avoid defeat. Arteta's mindset, they've stopped City playing twice already this season. They've done it again. They've now taken 8 points from the mini league with City and Liverpool, which is five more than either of the other two sides. So from that point of view, they've played the top teams perfectly well. They've lost the last seven league games at City. Their away record against big six sides is not good. So you can see why Arsenal's idea yesterday was let's make sure we avoid defeat. The only way that we sort of lose control of this title race in regard to City is if we lose. Let's not do that. I do wonder whether, in hindsight, they'll think of that as a slight opportunity missed when City were wounded, when they did have so many defenders out, whether they could have been slightly more proactive. But at the same time, the best two chances of the game probably went to City when Haaland weirdly just sort of stumbled over the ball.
Well, he's a League Two player.
I mean, he certainly scored goals in League Two. And then there was the header opportunity late on where, I can't remember who it was, he just sort of, was it Akanji? I think just didn't go for the header when all he had to do was put his head in it and it was in. So neither of those would register in terms of shots because they end up not having the shot, but they were the clear two chances in the game. So I can see why both sides sort of think, nil-nils, it's all right, it's fine. And the paradox of that is that Liverpool end up being the side that benefits from that, which is the fascination of a three-horse race, I guess.
Well, I mean, it seems to me, though, that the draw is definitely a better result for Arsenal than for Manchester City. That's a great result. Like, if you saw the Arsenal players after the game, Odegaard and Saliba doing their interviews, they're like, oh, we're never satisfied when we don't win. But you're like, come on, like, I've seen you. Odegaard looked pretty, frankly, delighted. Like it was a great result. I mean, for City, that's a missed opportunity. I know they had injuries, but like you expect them to win their home games, and they've been struggling to win these games this season. Once again, they haven't managed to do it.
Well, I mean, that depends what you think is going to happen over the next nine games. But it's clearly there's no guarantees. But I would suspect City will close that 1 point gap on Arsenal. This was a chance for Arsenal to make the gap 7 points, and they. Do I mean seven? Hang on, 67, 4 points, sorry. Yeah. And they didn't do that. So, yeah, if you look at the game in the abstract, yes, the draw was a better result for Arsenal. In the specifics of the game, playing a wounded City, that was, and I felt the same with the Liverpool game against City 2 weeks ago, that it was a chance for Liverpool to open up a bit of clear water, which they didn't take, given how...
Oh, yeah, but they clearly regretted that. I mean, they were the ones... Again, it's the home game. It's a big opportunity to win. Like, I think it was clear that Liverpool finished that game the more disappointed. I mean, Guardiola, I think, had made changes to hang on to a draw with 20 or 30 minutes left in the game.
Yeah, but I mean, I just wonder whether... Arsenal got out of that game what I think they were quite happy to... If you'd offered them that 24 hours earlier, they'd happily taken that. I do just wonder whether... They look back on that at the end of the season and think that was a chance to finish City and we didn't take it.
Yeah. John, just on the Haaland being a League Two player thing that Roy Keane said, we sort of know what he's getting at. Obviously, it's a bit of a soundbite. I mean, Haaland is a pretty useful player. We all agree. But Keane also said... he'll definitely improve in this aspect. Like, having said his all-round play is like that of a League Two player, he said that will definitely improve over the next few years. Do you think he is definitely going to improve? I mean, when Keane says that, I suppose the argument is, he just learns more about playing football. He becomes more experienced. He gets better at making decisions, blah, 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 blah. Against that, he, at the moment, is physically in incredible condition, which... isn't necessarily going to last. I mean, he has it now, but he won't always. Do you think Erling Haaland that we see right now is the best Erling Haaland that we're ever going to see? I don't mean in the last few weeks, because I know it hasn't been like his greatest season, but do you think he's ever going to have a better season or really be a better footballer than he was, for instance, last season when they won the treble and he scored all those goals?
I think there's a couple of things to tease out here, because on the one hand, when people talk about Haaland being good or bad. Often what they're talking about is simply the finishing rates that he's going through. And obviously this season, for whatever reason, he isn't finishing at the rate that he was last season, which is the most important metric by which to judge a striker, of course. But let's not forget that we're talking about a player here who, across his whole career until this season, has been scoring more goals at almost every level, I think, than having been games played, which is an incredible statistic that is not matched by anyone in, I don't think, in certainly in the modern era. So we're talking about a guy who is probably the greatest of all time when it comes to scoring goals in the modern era. If the question is, has he reached a point now where he's going to decline? I simply don't buy that. I think he's having an off season.
No, it's not that he's not necessarily that he's looking at a decline. It's just like, can you assume, as Keane seemed to do in his qualification, that, oh, you know, obviously he'll get better at all these things, but, you know, I'm not sure that necessarily it's going to add up to a better Erling Haaland than we already see.
Sure, and that brings me to the other aspect of this, which is tactical fit, and I suppose that is maybe the more interesting question right now, because it seems as though Manchester City, despite the fact that they get, for example, last season, got a huge boost from having one of the greatest finishers the world has ever seen on their team, there were also tactical dimensions there that raised questions about whether or not he was actually negating them in terms of their attacking upsides, particularly. And, you know, the difference is that this season, when his finishing has dropped off, it's very hard to justify his inclusion in the team when all he seems to do is simply miss chances, right? He's not doing a huge amount of link-up play. He's not particularly, like, effective out of possession. He's not even, you know, dragging players around to create space for other teammates, which then raises the question, then, what is this guy a net negative? And I suppose those are the sorts of calculus that the Manchester City coaching staff and analysts will have to work out themselves. But it is funny that we went from a period when Manchester City didn't play with a traditional striker, and the conversation was all focused around the fact that all they need now is a traditional striker and they'll be unbeatable. And now they have their traditional striker, and the conversation is moving back to maybe they should have stuck with their false nine approach, where they went with more mobile, attacking, creative players who could create attacking opportunities for other teammates around them.
Well, they got treble, Edward.
Yeah, absolutely. And you would think that in the long run that will be the norm, that sort of level of performance from Haaland than this season. But yeah, I suppose the big question then is, to what end has this season been, you know, just simply hammering away with the same blunt instrument rather than trying to find solutions? But I have to push back on the claim that Erling Haaland is a League One player.
League Two player.
Yeah. I simply don't think that's fair. I think that, as I say, what we're seeing here is a level of confidence drop, particularly because I guess he's not been through this sort of situation before. He's not been under as much pressure before, and not playing at this level with the same sort of scrutiny before last season. So, I think that the questions there are, how do you solve this problem? Is it doing individual work with Haaland, or is it finding ways of being able to fit him into the tactical system a little bit better?
What do you make of that, Jonathan? I mean, the one thing to note is that even though he obviously wasn't having a great game, I mean, he was lumbering around, he was barely involved. He obviously had that weird miss that you referred to. But he stayed on. You know, Guardiola didn't want to be like, yeah, you know, I'm chasing a goal here, I'm going to take Haaland off. You know, maybe that type of move doesn't really go down well. He did have Julian Alvarez there, though, and I was thinking, you know, if there's ever a player who might be able to get a toe on a ball here in this really congested penalty area, he's the kind of guy I wanted to pitch right now, but Guardiola decided not to use him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Alvarez had a particularly good season either. I think he's maybe, after last season where he won everything, you know, won the treble and won the World Cup, I think there has been a bit of a, you know, a drop-off this season, which maybe is to be expected. He's still very, very young.
He's still loads of goals and assists, though, hasn't he? I mean,
he's given the ball away a lot this season. I think he's particularly the last sort of 2 or 3 months, I think he really hasn't played well. I think if he were playing well, we might have seen him start games ahead of Haaland, because Haaland's been so off the ball. But I think where you see the problems with Haaland in that City setup is a game like yesterday where the opposition sit deep. And what he's really, really good at is hitting space behind the opponent, and De Bruyne playing those three balls to him. And the cup game at Luton is a great example of that. And you'd think, because of the size of Haaland is, that he's actually a great asset when a team sits deep against you, because City can put balls in the box. They can maybe be a little bit less precise in the build-up than they would like to be. And his size, you know, his evident abilities in the air would produce goals. But he hasn't scored a header since October the 29th against Manchester United, which is an astonishing run. And that includes that you know, the who was it against? The incredible miss. Was that against Liverpool?
The over the bar. That was Man United, yeah. Wasn't it? That was
against United. Sorry, that's right. Yeah. It was the first half against United. And so clearly his confidence with heading has gone completely. And he seems bafflingly unable. I mean, I'm sure that will come back, but it's not there at the moment. And I do want... I mean, I suspect that Guardiola is so good. I suspect that the resources City have are so vast that these will outweigh patterns we've seen in the past. But it does sometimes happen that you get a moment of sort of flowering of a team. So you think of Ajax in say, 73, which was probably there. The most aesthetically pleasing football they played in their 3 European Cups. Or you look at the title that Liverpool won in 87-8, where Dalglish made them a much more open, much more attacking side than they had been in under Paisley. And you sort of think, oh yeah, this is a whole new level that they're going to. It's the City last season winning the treble. And actually it turns out that in that blossoming, something is lost. And I think you often find that happens with a moment of creative tension. So what you had with Ajax was Stefan Kovac coming in. It was his second season, but he was a much more liberal coach. He's prepared to give the players a lot more freedom than Minas Michels had been. Dalglish had opened things up after the strictures of Paisley. And then here with Haaland coming in and being something different to how Guardiola City played before. And it may be that there is this pattern that creative tension produces or can produce great spark, which leads to new heights, but that then can't be sustained, that the tension is unsustainable. And what I found interesting with Haaland this season is that Guardiola seems to have stopped trying to change him. That countless examples last season of Guardiola bawling at Haaland. I remember in the game against United at Old Trafford.
Yeah, screaming at him to
screaming at him. And very clearly the hand gesture being, drop off, you've got to come deeper, you've got to come deeper. He's not doing that. He's accepted Haaland is this other thing. And that I think is interesting, that he's sort of like, okay, he's not going to adapt to my team has to adapt to him. And maybe they have just lost something as a result of that.
Yeah.
If I could jump in at this point, one of the things I've noticed actually in the difference between last season versus this season is that the way that Haaland attacks space in the air is very different to the way that most Premier League strikers do. Often what he will do is he'll drop off to the back post. And I think in most instances, when Premier League strikers do that, it's because they want to attack the front post. So they're almost creating the space that they want to attack. Mm. And he doesn't do that. So how many times last season did we see him scoring back post headers where you would expect him to be running in at the front post? And I think defenders were confused about that last season, because almost every other striker will create the space at the back post to be able to attack the front post. And I think that what we're seeing, we saw it a few times yesterday actually, is that now teams are happy defending him with the far centre-back rather than the near centre-back, and it gives him much less space at the back post. So I do think that that's an element of adaptation that teams have taken against him that just makes him less of a prospect in those sorts of situations. But that's the reality of the Premier League. The reality of the Premier League is you get a season of grace in terms of the tactical and technical aspects that, as if you do them with any sort of intensity to any great effect, will very quickly be picked up on by coaches and players and you won't be able to do them the following season.
Yeah, I do like that idea though of Haaland basically being something completely different from Guardiola's. Like Guardiola's, reminded me of like a kind of a Roman centurion in the borders of Germania or something, who has somehow managed to capture this ice troll from the forest and kind of lets it run right at the front of his legions. And this is what's been happening all along. But this kind of gets to this whole, I mean, you said, Jonathan, Guardiola is so good. That was definitely something you said. I thought you were imitating Guardiola. You said Pep is so good.
I meant it. I wasn't being facetious as he tends to be.
Pep is so good. Now, not everybody agrees. You know, a lot of people agree, but not everybody agrees. And this match, you know, maybe it was fuel to this raging fire that's been going on, this big picture fire in football, which involves the system of which Guardiola is the ultimate exponent. You know, the whole system of ideas, the way of seeing the world, that is positionism, versus the, let's say the opposite of that, relationism. And I see that Jamie Hamilton, who, as we people, I'm sure who listen to the podcast will be aware of Jamie Hamilton, who has written a lot and talked a lot on Twitter about relationism, making the comment, I think barbed, with the XG, he refers to the XG philosophy tweet, Man City 0.85, Arsenal 0.73, 0-0. Pretty boring game, it looks like. And he says, Pep and Arteta completed positionism. He's indicting this coach-driven, system-oriented way of playing the game and of seeing the world. John, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it's the million-dollar question in modern football tactics. To maybe clarify what the terms of the debate are, and to be honest, a lot of the debate about the debate is purely semantic and often misses the fact that at heart it is supposed to be about football, and often isn't very much about football. But the very heart of the debate is that the way that Pep Guardiola plays football is the sort of stereotype, the archetype of this approach called positional play. Jamie Hamilton calls it positionism because I think he wants to make the debate binary. He wants to make it between this one approach versus this other approach. And he juxtaposes that against this secondary approach, which he calls relationism. Now, as far as I understand his position on this, positionism is this notion that Pep Guardiola he treats the idea of spatial location on the field as the most important thing about football. So the players have to rationally adopt positions on the field. They have to spread themselves out. They have to create space and use that space as a way of being able to progress the ball down the field and generate dangerous scoring situations. And his argument is that this approach eventually will curtail the freedom of the players because they're no longer able to do the things that football players are supposed to do. They have to just obey instructions. They have to make sure they're adopting the right positions on the field. And the result is that we end up with these very, very stale games. And the solution to all of this is what he calls relationism, which is this idea that actually what we need to do is rely on the relations between the players to solve these problems rather than the positions that these players adopt to solve these problems. So, if that sounds a little bit floppy and the logic seem a little bit, the terms of engagement seem a little bit loose, I think that's because they are. I think there's a lot going on, and my frustration with the debate is more about the debate than the terms. I think that, you know, there are obviously aspects of what he's saying that are true. Pep Guardiola does care about using the spaces around players as ways of generating ball progression, and perhaps some managers take it too far. I think that you could argue that Pep Guardiola and Arteta, for that matter, are buying into this approach in ways that could eventually hurt them. But I also think that a lot of the debate sort of becomes quite aesthetic and quite subjective very quickly, because the suggestion is that Pep Guardiola and Mikel Arteta are sort of ripping the heart out of what football is supposed
bloodless
to be.
Bloodless tyrants. Brain in a jar. This is like the old sort of logic versus intuition, you know, science versus poetry.
Sure.
The machines versus humanity. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
And it's very reductive, in my opinion, as a result. But I think it is worth having conversations about some of the ideas, but to set it up as one thing versus the other is a false dichotomy. For me, because I think, you know, the coaches who use positional ideas can also use relational ideas, and you know, positional play is evolving. This idea that we've sort of come to the end of positional history and it's boring. The game between Arteta and Guardiola represents the highest form of positional play, and everyone was sent to sleep by it. So we can just ignore all of this now and just move into the sunny uplands of beautiful relational play, which, you know, looks very similar to Brazil in the 1980s. I just don't think that it's quite that simple.
Hey, that'd be good though, John, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, we've just seen a game where all these great players, you know, beautiful players, Kevin De Bruyne, Martin Odegaard, you know, wonderful footballers, just laid out like butterflies pinned to a display board. that's what Pep Guardiola and Mikel Arteta want. What do you think, Jonathan, as you survey this raging debate between positionists and relations? Do you kind of wish that you hadn't started all this stuff? do you feel a sense of guilt at all as you see what's happening now?
So is your question like, do I feel like Karl Marx looking at the Soviet Union in the 1950s?
More if Dr. Frankenstein had created lots of creatures instead of just one, and they were all absolutely running riot on Twitter, and you know his thoughts on that.
I think they're probably less dangerous than the monster. As far as I'm aware, they haven't killed any innocent young women yet. And I mean, some of them I really wouldn't put it past them. I have to say, I find the debate very hard to follow. It's some of the jargon of it, I just don't quite follow what it means. John's right. The idea that this is a dichotomy is obvious nonsense. And if you read... Lobanovsky talked about how the coalitions between players are more important than the players themselves. I mean, that sounds to me pure relationism.
I don't know if we'd say more important than the players themselves. I mean, I think that sounds a bit positional.
Well, I mean, that was probably Lobanovsky deliberately being provocative in the way that he was. But I think he was speaking at a time when conceptualizing of a football team as a single unit made of 11 components rather than 11 separate components was radical, and that was his insight. So I can understand why he was sort of pressing the claims for the coalitions rather than the individuals within it. Equally, you know, Saki's point that I think Saki even at one point said there are no positions, that every player must take up a position on the field according to four factors: his teammates, the opponent, the ball, and the space, which again doesn't seem to be rigid in any way about what a position
doesn't seem to fit neatly into one or the other side.
And then I've seen people talking about relationism seems to be compared frequently to jazz. This idea that I think I've been accused in as far as I follow it at all, which as I say is not very much. So if I'm misrepresenting this, I apologize. I apparently, in inverting the pyramid, I gave the idea that improvisation could only be conducted on an individual basis. And the argument against that is you look at a jazz quartet improvising together, which is fine and true, but the big and very obvious difference is a jazz quartet is not jazzing against another jazz quartet. You don't have a problem of an opposition. Your struggle is with the musical form itself. It's not against a direct opponent who's trying to stop you jazzing. So yeah, lost the metaphor.
But I think that is interesting because you see one of the things about this kind of debate, and which is, I mean, when you see the kind of the two sides of the debate, this is something which has been going on for a long time in many spheres other than football. But football is a game. The end of the day, it's actually a game with rules and a specific objective. It probably can be optimized. Like, there probably is a right way to play it in terms of you are more likely to win playing this way than if you play another way. Like, the ideas are tested on the field against each other.
Well, this is where AI is really interesting. And we've seen the talk about AI looking at corners, but AI really could find the best way. I think so far we don't know what the best way is. One of the football's beauties is there are multiple ways.
But it looks as though this Guardiola way is pretty, you know, maybe the best way that's been come up with so far. I mean, you know, and obviously we had in the World Club final in which the Fernando Diniz's Fluminense played Pep Guardiola's Man City. It was a 4-0. It wasn't close. I suppose that the problem is it's not like you can't control for the fact that City have much more money and better players. Maybe we were just seeing the better players, the better footballers winning the matches they always were going to, and Guardiola stealing all the credit.
I mean, yeah, this is where the debate becomes so floppy for me, because, you know, we were being told that relationism represented this play style that was valuable in and of itself because it could take apart positional approaches. And then when they lost that game 4-0, the debate then very quickly shifted to the questions about whether or not hypercapitalism has ruined football. And I think that part of my reticence to get into the debates too much is because so much of the contextualizing of these debates is slippery. So if you adopt whichever position works for you in the moment, and on one level you want to say this is a better tactical way of playing than the dichotomous position of positionism, the word position being overused here, I'm sorry about that, but on the other hand, when it doesn't work in those contexts, then we move it to a more sort of cultural debate about whether or not the reason why, you know, coaches like Pep Guardiola and Mikel Arteta are playing this sort of optimized game, as you call it, is because of the money involved. And, you know, again, it's a fair critique, and it's a critique that's worth having. But again, I think it becomes part of the context within which the debate is happening in a way to suit whatever you want to get out of that debate, which I find a little bit intellectually disingenuous. But I think there's a few things that we could talk about here. One of them is, you know, the assumption that Pep Guardiola is the end point of positional play. And I just simply don't buy that argument. I think that as a school of thought, he has been obviously a very important advocate of this approach and has had a huge amount of success with it. But I also think that it is evolving. And I think that some of the critiques that are being made of it here are fair. And I think coaches are finding those sorts of solutions. I think Xabi Alonso is a great example of a coach who uses positional ideas, who is trying to offset some of the problems that we get with Pep Guardiola's approach, which is that it's too safe, it's too risk averse, and it's easy for teams to defend against it, and not necessarily even at the highest level. How many times have we seen Brentford's 5-3-2 cause problems to Pep Guardiola? And that, you know, that's the conceit of the whole discussion. It's like, okay, well, Pep Guardiola has generated this way of playing where, you know, eight games out of 10, he's probably going to win. There's two games where he might drop points, but over the course of a season, he's going to win because it's the most effective way of playing. That was the case in the past. Is it the case anymore? I'm not so sure. I mean, we've got a three-way title race this season that suggests that, you know, for example, Jurgen Klopp's approach to positional play, and that's what it is still a form of positional play, is actually competitive at the highest level, and that's without all of this risk aversion that we're talking about here as well. So I think there's plenty more to this debate than just, you know, oh, here's Pep Guardiola versus Mikel Arteta. It's a boring game. No one won. We don't need to talk about this football anymore. We can just move on and talk about Fernando Diniz and as the
humanity versus the machines.
But I mean, that's where psychological history comes into play as well. That would Guardiola be this risk averse if he hadn't had in the Champions League a series of freakish defeats that seem to have driven him mildly insane? That you know, he's looking at those games and he's thinking, well, I've done everything right here, my team has dominated, and yet somehow we still managed to lose to Lyon, to Monaco, to Atletico when he was at Bayern in that ludicrous game, to Inter when he was with Barcelona. Like, freakish games kept on happening to him. Mm-hmm. And of course it's understandable that if that keeps happening to you, if you see you're better and somehow you keep not winning, you're trying to minimize risk to stop that happening again. Mm-hmm. And then you're moving into a realm that yes, it's tactical, but it's not about theory. It's not just about theory. It's about theory conditioned by by history and by mentality and by psychological, I mean, trauma's too strong a word, but by psychological trauma.
Yeah.
And also, this is what I was saying about that 4-1 loss at the Etihad last season for Arsenal. Like, clearly that traumatised Mikel Arteta, and he changed the way that his team were playing and made it more defence first, because, again, it's one of those situations where, I mean, the first goal that they conceded in that game, they pressed super well, caused City all kinds of problems, and John Stones played it long, and it, you know, two touches, and then City have scored, and you just kind of think, we've done everything right there, and we've come out the loser in this scenario. So, yeah, it's definitely, there's definitely psychological elements to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've never spent this long talking about a 0-0 in my life. But I kind of feel as though, well, that's not true, actually, because there's been a few Ireland podcasts that we've had to do. But that something about the reaction to this game is like, it, I think, resonates with it. Or there's a sense of that the world in which we live is increasingly controlled and rationalized and systematized. And these guys, as they grip their players, you know, as Guardiola tells off Grealish, you're like, poor Grealish. I mean, that there's all kinds of reactions to this. Like, relationism is part of the reaction, you know, like a kind of a rejection of this. The December 2006 goal of the month video is part of the reaction. Do you think maybe not enough in it for me? Like the kind of increasing bloodlust of football fans who hate, who want to see basically more violence involved in the game, is also part of the reaction against this type of football.
So what was the December 2006 goal of the month reference?
Oh, come on. You must have seen the December 2006 goal of the month video. It's the month when Essien, come on. Michael Essien scored that goal against Arsenal.
Oh, he smashes it from like 25 yards.
It's a Drogba goal against Everton in there. It's basically just a series of, I think Van Persie's goal against Charlton is in there. It's just this unbelievable collection of just absolute, thunder bastards, let's say, from wherever on the pitch. Doesn't matter. Is the Portsmouth, Matty Taylor, is he in there? Just a ridiculous long range. And it's basically like, what's happened to my game? You know, where's my game gone?
XG sort of neutering that, you mean? The sort of players recognising there's a minimal chance of scoring, and so continuing to progress the ball up the pitch rather than taking on these 25-yard shots.
Everyone tries to walk it in now. Whereas then, you know, players just, when players were players, you know, sometimes they just twatted it in from wherever. And, you know, why can't we go back to that? But what I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, I do wonder if the kind of the wish to decriminalize foul play is actually is also part of this. It's like, you know, any way that we can find to kind of introduce an element of kind of chaos into what's becoming just increasingly controlled.
Well, I think there probably is something in that. Yes, and I think one of the reasons why Klopp's Liverpool are so popular outside of Liverpool is that they do represent chaos. And you know, that's been another one of these sort of ongoing strands that your pretentious columnists like me kind of keep on dwelling on. It is the Apollonian against Dionysian with Guardiola against Klopp, that one wants to order everything. And his fear of these freakish results leads him deeper and deeper into order. Whereas Klopp's, you know, great gift has been to try and harness the chaos, let the chaos happen and try and guide it. And the result is Liverpool keep going behind, keep having to come back, but they keep on doing it. And I guess it's also related to the way that when City won the treble last season, a lot of the discussion was, it didn't feel as much fun as when United won the treble in 99. Well, no, because United in 99 was chaos, and chaos is fun. It's fun to watch. So I guess then it becomes, you know, what do we actually want our football to be? Do we want it to be fun for the neutral? Do we want it to stir us? Do we want it to be about the winning of games only? And I think it probably should be a mix of a lot. You know, I'm very resistant to the idea that football is entertainment, but football is part of show business. No, it's part of sport, and sport is different. Sport is fundamentally about the winning. It's not about doing tricks. But at the same time, bloodless winning is not that entertaining. And I think one of the reasons that City haven't captured a wider public is that, and one, you know, and obviously their ownership is another factor in that.
Sounds to me as though you see Liverpool as the heroes of the three protagonists in this title race, Jonathan. What do you think, John?
Sorry,
it's just that everything you said there just made it sound as though, you know, Liverpool were kind of the good guys, you know, fighting for everything human in the game, whereas these... What about you, John? What do you think? Are Liverpool the good guys in this three-way title race?
Yeah, it's funny because I tweeted about this yesterday, and my mentions ever since have been full of, like, Liverpool fans thinking it's the greatest threat ever and Arsenal fans thinking it's awful. When my intention was never to suggest that one approach is good or bad. I'm very much with Jonathan on this one, that we live in a world where everyone either expects to be entertained or, if they support a football club, to win. And there's a curious dissonance between those two positions, right? So, for example, Arsenal fans today will be like, I don't care that the game was boring for the neutral. We got what we wanted out of it. And it complexifies the conversations about it, because on the one hand, like, I'm employed by a media company to be a tactical analyst. And so I'll watch a game like the Arsenal-Man City game yesterday and find things of interest in it. But I will also watch the Liverpool-Brighton game and very much enjoy it from the chaotic point of view that you're talking about there, because we do enjoy goals and we do enjoy tension and we do enjoy the possibility of, you know, someone making a mistake or things actually happening in a game. The beauty of tactics and tactical evolution is that it has always been dialectical. There's always been one way that seems to be the best way, and you think, oh, how will it ever not be the way that wins? I mean, talk about Spain in the 2010s era, where people thought, oh, there's no situation where Spain won't ever just win every international tournament ever. And then within a couple of years, they got battered by the Netherlands in that game. And I think the story of tactical evolution, it follows that ebb and flow, right? There was a point in time when we felt Manchester City are never going to get beaten ever again. Yes, okay, occasionally Liverpool will take a title off them in either in the Champions League or in the Premier League, but City's approach is always going to be the dominant one. And I genuinely think that we're moving beyond that now. I think that there are questions to be asked about the way that Pep Guardiola's teams approach the game. And I think that I find that hugely exciting. I think that you know, especially because every tactical approach has an aesthetic attached to it. And I think for most people, the high Guardiolan style is quite boring when it's played at its highest level against someone like Arteta. But, you know, I've already mentioned Xabi Alonso. There are other coaches coming through who are trying to address some of the issues with that approach. You know, everyone's getting hyped about Thiago Motta at the moment, and he's doing some interesting things in Italy. And that those are the things that I really live for as a tactical analyst. I enjoy these sort of high-level chess matches that we get every once in a while in this season, and people seem to treat as representative of the entire of modern football. But I also enjoy Andoni Areola at Bournemouth. He's probably my favourite coach to watch in the Premier League right now. And I think, you know, the things that Ange Postecoglou is doing, again, all influenced by the ideas of positional play, but very, very different to what people mean when they talk about positional play, using sort of Pep Guardiola as the high priest of that style. So, yeah, I think that Liverpool aren't the good guys, or and City aren't the bad guys, at least from a tactical point of view. But it's the diversity here that's good. It's good that Liverpool are doing what they're doing, because otherwise this title race would be a foregone conclusion between two teams playing in very similar ways. And so I'm glad that we've had Jurgen Klopp in the Premier League for the last decade, because he's added that variety. And I think what that means is that people realise that there are solutions outside of this high positional approach. And diversity will always bring more chaos, because it will provide solutions. And chaos, as you say, is much more fun for the fans.
Yeah.
But I think that feeds into the good guy, bad guy dynamic that people are trying to foist on this. And as I say, I think the ownership is part of that. But it's always the case that your instinct is to side with the rebel against the hegemony. And so Guardiola style has been hegemonic for, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And that's a very long time in footballing terms. These eras tend to last for 8, 10 years, 12 maybe. 15 is a long, long time. So I think there is a sense of stasis, and we do need, you know, an eruption. And it's those eruptive games that are the most fun. So the Netherlands-Spain game in 2014 was one of those games you watch with your mouth open, knowing you're witnessing history. And that's something very, very exciting. And you know, it sort of feels that club football is ripe for something like that.
Well, listen, not for the first time. We've ended this by giving thanks to Jurgen Klopp for making things interesting in the Premier League. Jonathan Wilson and John McKenzie, thanks very much for making most of the last hour. Pretty interesting, yeah, from my point of view anyway. I guess we'll have to leave it there.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
He agrees with plenty, just it's always who's saying it, it's never what's actually said. 90% of anything is who's saying this, and 10% is what are they actually saying. So the 90% in Giles' case is, oh, it's that twat.
Looking right at me. John is the best football brain in the world. If I could be that
guy instead of me. He just thinks I'm an annoying twat. I'd never let you do.
Never let you down. But if you're talking about the press, which you're talking about, have this opinion of Guardiola, it doesn't necessarily mean the football people have.
Yeah, I think I do like Ken Early's work. He writes fluently and thinks cogently, but I think he's wrong.
The press come and go, as we know. You mentioned Ken Early. Well, yeah. You know, I wouldn't necessarily agree with anything Ken Early says about football.
He just thinks I'm an annoying twat. I mean... You know, what can you do? Can't please everyone.
Ugh, we should talk about Gus Poyet rejecting us then, Ken, I suppose. I mean, what is going on here? How can the FEI keep getting played by these people? How did it take them 5 months to not hire Lee Carsley? I mean, is Poyet the man they expected to unveil in April? Is he the mystery man that we were going to get after the international window? Did they really speak that confidently about a gentleman's agreement they had with Gus Poyet?
Gus Poyet.
Honestly, I mean, how can they be so bad at this?
I don't know. I don't know the answers to your questions. I mean, as far as I know, the official position is still that we're going to have an unveiling within the next 2 weeks. You know, that the manager will be... will be coming forward. I mean, there's, you know, not everything that's been reported about this, not everything that's been speculated about has turned out to be true. I mean, there are still things that don't make any sense to me. Like with the Carsley thing. How can, if as Carsley says, we talked about it in November, did he say? And it never went any further. I didn't push it. If that's true, why did they not say at an earlier point, it's definitely, you know, forget Lee Carsley, stop talking about that. I mean, it would suggest to me that, well, maybe it wasn't completely finished at that stage. Maybe, you know, from both sides, there wasn't neither of the parties believed that it was definitely not going to happen. You know, because otherwise, if you're Lee Carsley or if you're the FAI and you know this isn't going to happen because you don't want to do it, then surely you let that be known at some point. You know what I mean? But that never happened until March or whatever. There was talk of Poyet being offered a five-year contract was reported. I think that's also been denied. I mean, it's just,
It's so crazy. I'm reluctant to believe that it was true that you would offer Gus Poyet that kind of thing. So I prefer to believe that's one of the things that wasn't true. I don't know. I mean, it's gonna be an interesting few days to see what happens. I mean,
it's a resounding vote of confidence in our eventual manager John O'Shea.
Hopefully John O'Shea doesn't let this kind of stuff bother him. People have said.
That would be a concern now.
I don't think it's. Like, I'm not concerned. I think John O'Shea's got the patience to wait this one out. You know, maybe for the FAI to realize that Mr. Wright is staring them in the face. You know, I think he can. I think he's a big enough man to roll with it. You know, he appreciates that maybe people said some things. People laid out some parameters that maybe suggested a certain type of coach that turned out maybe wasn't available or wasn't interested or. Whatever, one way or the other, I think he has to be the favorite. I think John O'Shea definitely has to be the favorite to get the job. Although, you know what? Why are we talking always about managers? Why are we talking always about managers when actually there's also, you know, it's not just managers who are involved. I mean, after that long piece we've just done, it is important to remember that football isn't actually all about managers. And somebody has emailed us to remind us of that of another part of football often under discussed, players. What about players? One player in particular, a shout out to Jimmy Dunn. So this is from Aidan McGlue. Now this is funny because this is the having not heard a lot about Jimmy Dunn for a very long time, yesterday I heard about Jimmy Dunn from two separate people. One of them being Aidan McGlue. The other one being someone on WhatsApp. Jimmy Dunn, he scored a goal, sure. He scored a nice goal on Good Friday. Maybe there's a bit of buzz about this guy, Jimmy Dunn. But, okay, let me just read out the email from Aidan. A shout out to Jimmy Dunn. Whoever Owen eventually anoints as the new Ireland manager needs to look at this man, Jimmy Dunn, as his on-field leader. Seamus is winding down and as proficient and athletic as the likes of Omar Babdelli, O'Shea and Collins have been. We don't have a successor to the sheer, bloody-minded, redoubtable, indefatigable spirit of Shane Duffy. We can all concede Duffy has less natural ability in that trio, but his nuisance value and threat in the opponent's box is sorely missing, especially with Egan sidelined and getting on himself. Step forward, Jimmy Dunn of QPR. 2 months ago, he was slipping down the ranks of my club, usurped at centre-half by the wily Steve Cook and more agile Jake Clark-Salter. So, faced with an injury crisis, our Basque saviour, Marty Cifuentes, was forced into using Jimmy as an emergency right-back. Since then, he's been a driving force in our climb out of the relegation zone. He has been coined the Irish Cafu, culminating in his stunning half-volley winner in the 92nd minute of our relegation six-pointer against Birmingham on Good Friday. He is someone who steps up and rises to any occasion and level. And as an English subscriber to the show, I feel indebted to our Irish listeners to flag him up. We're going to need leaders in this new era to cajole the likes of Ferguson, Azaz and Smallbone. Get Jimmy Dunn in amongst them. He is the desire of Oak Bennett, the nouse of Doherty. That must be a typo. And the aerial threat of his namesake, Richard, to become a late-flaring Irish legend. Cheers, Aidan. Wow. Jimmy Dunn is only 27, Murph.
Wow.
All I'm saying is,
can I just
maybe
say
you're barking up the wrong tree with all this Irish managerial talk. Apparently, we've got a Cafu. And the thing is that the other person who mentioned Jimmy Dunn also used the word Cafu. And I'm like, okay, this is too much. I'm getting Cafu from every angle.
Yeah. What I also love about Jimmy Dunn is that, you know, he sounds like an Irish footballer, doesn't he? You know, Jimmy Dunn. He could definitely have gotten like 30 caps over a 12-year period between 1959 and 1971.
One of the guys that Arthur Fitzsimons,
I mean,
the security guard in the old Newstalk, would have
he's got a brilliant Dublin street football nickname that, you know, I can petition our listeners to come up with. Jimmy Socks Dunn or whatever.
Jimmy Cafu Dunn. Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty much it for today's show. We will be back in all our glory tomorrow for a look back at the National League finals, including that classic of a Division 1 final between Dublin and Derry with Michael Murphy and Paul Flynn. Enjoy the rest of your long weekend. Gurmagud, Ken.
Gurmagud, Akiron.
Agus, by me, Jay Conchlat, Amorik Slán.
I looks around, but there's Jerry Duff. Duffer's dad.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all.
It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.